Welcome to the Joint Angel Pool and Angel Capital Association conference call. This is Michael Price of CEO Ventures. I serve as the 2011 volunteer chair of angelpool.org, and I'll be moderating today's call. We have an excellent speaker on angel capital best practices today, Reid Hoffman, a partner at Greylock and co-founder of LinkedIn. Before we begin, just some quick housekeeping announcements. Everyone is currently in mute. A number of questions were submitted in advance that we will work our way through. But if you have any burning questions during the first part, once the speaker has finished with remarks, I will signal you to press star 6 toward the end to unmute your mic, and then you can go ahead and ask your questions. Just please, after you ask your question, please press star 6 again after asking your question so that the background noise does not get out of hand. After the speaker remarks, I'll then remind everyone how to unmute their phones to ask questions again. For those joining the call for the first time, both AngelPool.org and the Angel Capital Association are organizations of volunteer leaders who help angel groups across North America and are dedicated to helping their leadership build strong angel groups in their cities to drive jobs, innovation, and exciting new companies. For those angel groups that need additional capital to complete a seed round or that would like access to more deal flow, the Angel Pool Syndication Network is now the world's largest, providing easy monthly access to a large number of other angel groups and deals within their region. This also provides the members of each angel group total visibility into all the best deals in their region. AngelPool.org also organizes knowledge and educational events like this one to share best practices and lift each other's angel skills and knowledge. The Angel Capital Association provides in-person syndication meetings at both the regional and international levels, which is also highly valuable, along with exceptional training, courses, conferences, and many other key functions, such as serving as a public policy voice of the angel community. At the tail end of this call, we'll be updating everyone on the upcoming ACA conference dates, to include the annual conference coming in March, which will be in Austin this year. This ensures each angel group and their angels better fulfill their missions of helping entrepreneurs be more successful so that our portfolios, in turn, will also be more successful. With that, let's go ahead and begin. Today's speaker, again, is Reid Hoffman, a partner at Greylock and co-founder of LinkedIn. He'll be speaking on Internet and Investing 2.0. As quick background, Reid Hoffman is a partner at Greylock and co-founder and executive chairman of LinkedIn, which recently went public, as I think all of us are aware. Reid's areas of focus include consumer Internet, Enterprise 2.0, mobile, social gaming, online marketplaces, payments, and social networks. Reid likes to work with products that can reach hundreds of millions of participants and businesses that have network effect. Reid co-founded LinkedIn, the world's largest professional networking service, in 2003. LinkedIn is thriving with more than 63 million members in 200 countries around the world and a diversified revenue model that includes subscriptions, advertising, and software licensing. Reid led LinkedIn through its first 4 years into profitability as CEO. Prior to LinkedIn, Reid served as executive vice president at PayPal, where he was a founding board member. Reid is also a board observer at Airbnb, Agoala, and Swipely, an advisor to Groupon, and a director at Zynga, Mozilla, Six Apart, Shopkick, and Kiva. He is an angel investor in numerous influential internet companies, include Dig, Facebook, Flickr, Last.fm, Ning, Six Apart, and Zynga. Reid earned a master's degree in philosophy from Oxford University, where he was a Marshall Scholar, and a bachelor's degree in symbolic systems from Stanford University, where he graduated with distinction. Reid, the floor is yours, and thank you very much for agreeing to speak to all the angels across the U.S. and abroad today.
Well, thank you for inviting me to come and share a few observations. It's always kind of, you can't hear these over the phone, but you always kind of blush when you hear your bio, but it doesn't quite sound like yourself. Anyway, all right, so, you know, my goal is to and I hope that these comments are the right focus for this group. My goal is to kind of share in summary what my experience when I was doing angel investing and what was kind of the key considerations and thoughts, and hopefully they're not just kind of the, oh, yeah, we know all those, although we'll leave enough time for questions that if it's that, then we'll get to some specific questions, and if it's not, then hopefully it's useful. I thought I would start by talking a little bit about what the goals of angel investing are. And, you know, the obvious one, of course, is, strong returns, where you typically have a kind of a 5 to 9 year cycle And, you know, also typically, you know, when you have a portfolio, usually a small number of companies in the portfolio are the ones that really drive the return. But there's a little bit more than that that I think is certainly useful if you're planning on doing investing kind of professionally or something over time that you're better at. And, you know, one of them is kind of how you build the skill set knowledge in what you're doing. I kind of think of this as operant knowledge. And I'll come back to kind of some of the stuff, the reasons why I think that's key. And also kind of the, you know, for some of us, it's the, you know, part of the reason we do this is not just also pure returns, but also the creation of new things. And, you know, the economics have to work. But the kind of building things that change people's lives is also really important. Now, in terms of the key, you know, kind of three things that I look at as a way to do angel investing really well, you know, one is, you know, how well do you think about and do you work with your network? And I don't mean this as a LinkedIn discussion. I mean this as a I find that at least me personally, the network is entirely the function of being successful or not in terms of how I play the, you know, how I kind of made all my investments happen. And I'm going to go into some detail in each three, but I'll start with kind of highlights. So one is network. Second one is competitive edge. And I'm going to go into some depth in that. And then the third is the ability to get the next round of investment. And, you know, one of the things that I think was fairly decisive in looking at and doing my investing was basically all but two of my angel deals raised venture funds out of, like, 80. And, you know, part of that is because, you know, looking at it as a process by which you will be sequencing rounds of investment. How does this get into a stronger upward trend in terms of more network support, more capital, more ability to play it out is actually pretty important. So let's start with kind of network. The key thing about, you know, I think that I've never done investing personally by, like, saying, well, you know, I think it's going to be, you know, mobile games, and let me just go kind of call people and find mobile games, go to conferences and find people, because the ratio, the signal to noise ratio of that kind of, you know, raw output is, your raw approach is just overwhelming to me. And so, you know, occasionally you can see something really growing in you know, Compete or Alexa or something else, and you get to it, and that's pretty interesting. But even when I try to get to it, I still use my network as a way of doing it, as a way because to qualify, is the entrepreneur worth working with, is the expertise in terms of what's going on in a specific area. When deals are brought to me, are they deals that I should pay attention to and dig into? Because each one to dig in and really think that's kind of a heavy time commitment. And so, you know, part of how I've looked at, you know, kind of, I look at the whole world, and I think about this kind of network thinking. And most particularly in terms of doing my angel deals was always essentially when I talked to anybody within the angel community or entrepreneurs that I thought was smart, I'd say, you know, what other kinds of, you know, which entrepreneurs do you think are great, which deals do you think are great, and with key folks that I think I would be working with over decades, because you build these relationships, you invest in the relationships as part of investing in the network, I would make sure that I was adding value back into the network, that I was, you know, like, for example, if I had somebody that I didn't really have good deal flow with them, but I knew some of their portfolio companies, I would give them some comments or advice or introductions that would be helpful to portfolio companies. If there were, events that I was going to that I thought would be really useful to them, I would invite them to, or I'd set up a dinner in order to talk about things. And, you know, one of the really key things, the reason this is important, I think, in all investing, but it's particularly important in angel investing, because there's in that initial seed stage investment, there's such a high mortality rate, and there's so many things that can go wrong that I almost never did an angel investment only by myself. And the network of folks that you bring in is really key, and it's really important that that is kind of a shared intelligence, a shared work burden. And part of the ways of, like, for example, even when, you know, back in 2003, I'd only made, an investment in Ironport in 2001, and an investment in Friendster in 2002. So I hadn't really done a lot of angel investing before that. But even then, it would kind of like be, if someone just walked up to me, I would never go and take a lot of meeting time with them without qualifying them with the network stuff and finding out if other people, even not angel investors, you know, thought they were good people to work with and so forth, as a way of doing it in order to really focus on working with the right people. Because at least, you know, my experience with consumer internet in Silicon Valley is it's extraordinarily rare that the first idea, the first plan, the first distribution plan, even if the product is launched or is working, is really the thing that goes. There's a lot of pivoting that happens. And so it's really the quality of the people that you're working with. So, you know, part of the reason I put the Discovery Fund in place in Greylock was in order to continue to work with angels and the really high premium on which entrepreneurs that I, which deals I do is which entrepreneurs do I think, this person has a very good internet product sense, internet distribution sense, and will pivot a lot and will move. And the assessment of that is part of what the use of the network is for. So, you know, kind of at broad brush, you know, the network is everything in terms of deal flow, bringing in assistance, kind of reference checking, qualifying the people. And investing, you basically can't invest too little in it. You can maybe invest less intelligently, but investing in your network is really key, including with a long-term, you know, like decades-long horizon. So the second area, and this is one of the things I think is usually most tricky, is competitive edge. And, you know, there's a general focus on intelligence and believe in a technology trend, say, well, I can learn this. And one of the things that I realized from very early on was that the only thing I had a real competitive edge doing was consumer internet software, because I knew what the key variables are. I knew what how to do the product stuff. I knew what I could assess within a 5-minute conversation whether or not a company, you know, had at least some of the DNA, and I was familiar with the entire competitive landscape in terms of what was happening in the consumer net as products, but also who the other investors were, and you know, kind of had that complete map in my head. And so while I've made some investments outside of the consumer internet, I very quickly realized that every investment that I made outside of that, I basically wrote to zero. And this kind of gets back to what I was saying in terms of goals of angel investing is doing some offer knowledge, which is I did make some clean tech investments, and I did make some, like a hardware investment and so forth, all at small dollars and all at, okay, I'm going to learn how this area works. And it even goes all the way down to get a sense of how draconian of a competitive edge question that I ask myself and I think is relevant for being a really good investor is on the consumer internet, there's a lot of people who say, well, content can be good investments and that will be the new area and content will really work. And I kind of kept hearing that and I kind of didn't believe it. But I kind of went, all right, maybe, in fact, a lot of these folks know something I don't know. And until I see this and know this, like I could run a content business myself, I wouldn't be investing in this professionally, but I made one content consumer internet investment in Funny or Die, because I said, well, in the consumer internet, the whole game is about product distribution. I could make that product distribution angle work based upon, maybe humor is viral, there's various techniques in terms of social media and other things that make it work. And I'll make make this investment in order to see, to learn the dynamics and to see if there's a content investment maybe this week that one to learn on, as a way of kind of saying, all right, this investment I'm not, you know, like I think it's much higher risk than my typical portfolio where I know kind of what's happening, but I think there's a chance to raise more money. I think I'll learn stuff from it. I think, you know, if there is a kind of coming set of interesting content investments, this will be a good one to learn enough of that kind of operant knowledge about what are the key variables, even in kind of consumer internet context, in order to be able to recognize talent, advise effectively, have a network for later finance, and all the rest of that, and make that work. And, you know, one of the things that I think is really key is, you know, I basically, when I make an investment in something that I don't go, okay, this is high risk, and I initially write it to zero in my book. I mean, look, all these things are high risk, but this one, like, you know, if they want to invest in NanoSolar, it's like, I have no idea of clean tech stuff. I mean, everyone's talking about clean tech. I'll at least get a little bit of experience in this, but I wrote it to zero in my book. And still have it at zero in my book until I view that I can run the strategy myself. It's part of how I look at competitive edge at these kind of early stages. What would my strategy be? How would I drive this? What does the competitive landscape for this company look like? Do I understand all of that? And do I have a play that I would do? Not that the founder should do my play, because part of the evaluation of the person is that they are good enough to do that and iterate that, because if they're going to be spending, you know, 80, 100 hours a week doing this, they're the ones who are going to have the fast cycle to really generate that. But do I have a good enough sense that I go, yeah, I do A, B, and C, and I have a good sense or a good chance of running this? And that's how I look at, I know what I'm doing. And then I make sure that I look around to other folks who are consumer internet angel investors, many of whom I partner with, I collaborate with, part of the network, and I say, do I think that I am very strong relative to them? Do I think that I know things about, you know, viral distribution or SEO or, you know, the LAMP stack or product development or strategy or what are the operative niches or what's happening? Like when I saw the Facebook launched its first platform, F8, you know, the whole marketing hype and all of this is going to, the whole world's going to be social on the Facebook platform. And I looked at them and said, no, it's games. Like, games is a thing. And I know that because I know what the dynamics of the use of Facebook are. I know how things spread there. I know what things people most want to add into their Facebook news feed, you know, at its broad brush, not everybody, but, you know, at a scalable size, hundreds of millions. And so I'm really interested in game investments. And when one of the people I knew from the network, Mark Fingers, came to me and said, oh, I'm doing poker, I'm like, hey, do you have an interest in making this into a game network? And he said, yes, that's exactly what I'm doing. And I went, all right, great, I'm in. And actually, one of the things that, in terms of, you know, kind of a side note, that I kind of ran, you know, three different investments within consumer internet. The lightest was, you know, I really don't know this that well, but I want to learn. I think it's interesting. I think it could be a bold enough play where I put a very small amount of dollars, the smallest amount of dollars in the play. And, you know, sometimes would not make as much money because of that, but that's fine. The second one was, I think this is a really good play. I'm either leading it or part of the syndicate, but I'm basically interested in every available dollar, but I want to make sure that there's a syndicate of help to make sure that it maximally gets to raising a venture run, venture round and getting a size. And the third one was, I'm pretty sure this one will have a shot at a billion-dollar plus company, and so if I like the entrepreneur, I'll join the board. And I kind of use that as my kind of pre-stage. And, you know, the key thing to be thinking about when you think about competitive edge is to really, I mean, not just think yourself, but ask other people, you know, where do you think I fit in the ranking of people most able to help the kind of companies that you're focused on, in my case, consumer internet. And then figure out what are the things that are most important to change that ranking and that scale. And so, anyway, can't emphasize competitive edge for you, for what you know and what you're doing, and for the company in terms of what they're doing, enough. And actually, one big challenge about that, because, you know, I get asked a lot about how do you replicate Silicon Valley in other areas of the world, other areas of the U.S. And, you know, I've met with governors of states and everything else. And one of the things that I kind of emphasize is, well, it is not to create a complete replica. And, you know, one of the things about consumer internet is you say, well, theoretically, consumer internet companies could be anywhere in the world. Why is it so many of them cluster in the valley? And the answer is, a really good entrepreneur will be all in and will move to where doing that company is the strongest place to do that company, because they just want to make this work no matter what. And so I think different regions will end up with different kinds of tech specialties. And so, you know, one of the things that I, you know, advise folks in nearby states to California is they don't try to just build another alternative Silicon Valley. Do something that's a different stack of technology and assistance, or this is being on the governmental side. Because what's the advantage that the companies in my region have in order to compete and grow in those scale businesses? And this is, by the way, one of the things I think is really stunning and great about, you know, part of the reason is the Groupon effect. So I'm not sure Groupon could have started in Silicon Valley, because we tend to be really, you know, the folks here tend to be really bad at sales models and scaling large sales forces and so forth. We tend to be entirely platform and technology. We tend to be distribution. We don't tend to be very good at marketing. We tend to be very much, you know, obviously Steve Jobs and Apple's a massive exception. We tend to be really good at, you know, viral marketing or distribution through SEO or product discovery, these sorts of things. You know, PayPal with an eBay. And so what is the area that the skill set of talent as you grow this company can really compete within the area you're in? And what would people move here to do as a way of understanding that kind of competitive edge, and this company going to get that competitive edge? And then last, in terms of the kind of three key things in terms of stuff is doing, first, network technical competitive edge, was the ability to get the next round of investment. And, you know, to some degree you say, well, it comes trivial, obvious. But there's a lot of things that you can do to really try to really optimize that. Because you think, okay, at least in consumer internet, the next round of investment should come within 1 to 2 years, sometimes this month. What are the key cards, like, you know, you really optimize for, in my case, given it was consumer internet, was, all right, what will change in the next 6 to 12 months? Like, if we turn over the card, is it we're going to get really good distribution? Is there going to be really great product launch? It's the kind of thing that, you know, demonstrates there's a change in the marketplace. And then all of that will be very well set up to being a venture financeable company. And then what can I do to help that? And that's one of the reasons why you have a network of people, because then there's a whole network of people who are potential leads to different sources for the next phase of investment. You've also got essentially, you know, how, like, when I'm making an investment, I'm actually crafting in my head what the next deck looks like. Right, not that it, you know, things pivot and change and everything else. It's not like this is running on rails. It's a trick and goes from this step to the next step. But it's a question of, here are the key things that would be the investment thesis. So, for example, when I open up an investment deck, I basically look at, like, when I give advice, and this is part of the thing that I committed to all my angel investors, is I would help them with their next step. Because the really key thing to do is to have, like, very few decks that aren't the ones that I influence through this, but is that your very first slide is your investment thesis. It's the 3 to 7 hypotheses that, if they end up being true, are very valuable to a potential shareholder. And so what you're thinking about is, like, okay, which are the ones, why am I doing it? When I look at my investment thesis, I go, okay, well, I think, you know, the Facebook platform is going to massively open up gaming. I think it's going to cause a lot of distribution. I think that first movers in creating GameStop game will be engaging enough, and there will be clear enough economic models, which we don't know at the very beginning, but there will be clear enough economic models that the whole thing will work, and this will be a really good area. And everyone else is distracted, competitive edge, based upon, you know, like, oh, it's going to be productivity, and it's going to be to-do list software, and it's going to be all these other things. You know, it's going to be, you know, all these other things. I don't know. it's going to be this, and then this is what the next deck looks like in terms of how do you, you know, what the financing this is going to be. And so those are kind of the three things. And then as part of kind of investing in the consumer internet, how do these three things play in terms of what I'm, you know, what I think people should look at there? One of them is it's always about taking key risks for breakout. I almost never see an angel investment that really happens on when traction's already there. But the key risk is kind of like, will the viral marketing work? Will this be adopted within eBay or MySpace or a platform? Is the growing SEO, will that work? Is there some mechanism from a very small thing by which once that product will lead to a breakout adoption? And that breakout adoption is essential because one of the downsides when you look at the kind of, like everyone goes, wow, consumer internet, it's a lot cheaper to start a company now. And so it's kind of less risk and less capital. But downside is that there's thousands of consumer internet companies being started every year, maybe more. And the market can only adopt at a kind of at a mass level, maybe somewhere between 2 and 7 of these. part of what you're trying to do is this thing going to really rise above the noise in terms of how does the consumer internet thing, and the knowledge and ability and the play to do that are absolutely critical in, say, consumer internet investment. One of the other interesting things that frequently happens when people looking at seed stage, you know, kind of angel stage investments is they go, okay, what's the competition? And everyone tends to obsess about the competition being Google, Microsoft, you know, Amazon, eBay, Facebook, LinkedIn, whatever. And actually, unless it's coming directly at them, right, in which case very rarely can you actually build something from behind, that's not the competition. The competition is the other startups who are trying to occupy the same niche. And so knowing what the trends are in the other startups and what's really going on and which companies might be being created, because frequently if you have a deep network, you actually have a sense of what kinds of things are being created. So it's like, oh, this is one of N, and maybe this will work or maybe this won't work. So, you know, kind of last set of comments before we open up to questions are kind of ways to help entrepreneurs build value and then kind of how to work with these cities. On the ways to help entrepreneurs build value, there's a bunch of obvious stuff. Time working with them, working on the strategy, time helping recruit people in and getting advisors. But some of the stuff I think is really critical when it comes to kind of your knowledge, your competitive edge, what you're doing, which is how do you ask them hard questions that are the kind of questions that, you know, not just, oh, we believe in this, but the, and not just, you have to prove this to me, but like, here is the key hypothesis about what you're believing will work, right? So, you know, kind of, again, like, you know, kind of the Zynga thing from the early days was actually a hit game could be built into a network. And that we can get the competency on the people to do that. What I find in working with entrepreneurs is that I can't ask them a hard question in a way that they actually have the exact right level of both pushback and collaboration, that entrepreneur is probably not the right person who pivots and directs the right way. So what I mean by that is that person just go, oh, yeah, that's right, that's a great question, and they kind of take the note, and that's it. And you're like, okay. Well, you don't have enough conviction in kind of how you're thinking about it, what your plan A is, how this plays through, and that's actually a weakness that worries me. But it's equally a weakness that worries me if the person says, no, I'm not listening to you, I've got to completely write that question useless. What you're looking for is that combination of, okay, here's the things I'm thinking, here's where I think it's strong, here's where your question could be useful, here's what I might think about doing that if I was doing something with that, and if I see that in the interactive discussion with the entrepreneurs as I'm building up the investment, that leads me to think they'll have that kind of adaptability and flexibility in terms of how they're driving the consumer and startup. And that's really critical for the likely adaptation in terms of what they construct. And it's things like this in terms of helping entrepreneurs build value that also then build the value of your network in terms of how you're doing angel investing. Because, you know, what I found was key to kind of building up the really great deal flow was the number of people around me would say, oh, actually, this guy, you know, Reed was really helpful in my thinking through my kind of my pitch deck, my investment thesis, what is the key thing to do, whether or not my idea would work or not. If my idea didn't work, hey, we're going to try my idea anyway, what would fall back? And then that creates the kind of branding out as a way of doing it. So, and this will get to, you know, I think this is a natural transition to talk a little bit about kind of working with VCs, because, you know, one of the things that I'll kind of, like one of the key things I always told entrepreneurs to put into their pitch decks for these early stage was what are the key risks that they see in the business? Not, oh, Google crushes me, or, you know, oh, people just don't like my product, but, you know, what are the two or three risks that you're really obsessing about that are the real risks about can I get this business up and going? Because they're always there. And if they're not identified in the discussion with investors, angel investors first, VCs later, the investor should conclude one of two things. Either A, that the person is dumb, right, and doesn't understand the risks and just thinks that it's a perfect pitch from where they are out, or the person is deceptive, e.g. they have risks in their head, but they're not telling them to you because they're just trying to win your money in the deal and they're not really collaborating with you and treating you as a partner. And so I pushed all my angel deals to be very clear about what these are the ones, especially going and raising money from venture. You know, here are the risks, here's why we think we can solve them, and this is why we think it can be big. And that's the right way of approaching kind of VCs with the right kind of trust about, okay, this person isn't just trying to pitch me on the business, they're trying to talk to me like a partner. And when they say these things about why this business can be really big, they're also saying these things about what the real risks are and what to do. And to give you a sense of how rarely that's done, I get probably 10 to 20, maybe even 30 unsolicited pitches for companies in my email box, you know, per day. And I basically, I occasionally scan them. I don't really scan them anymore. But I basically always notice, always like, this is why this thing is the biggest thing ever, you know, from scratch. And there's not like any like, oh, and by the way, here are the risks we navigate, and here's why I think it work, and so forth. So it's clearly just treating me as kind of someone to sell to, not as someone to partner with. And part of the reason why I got all of my angel deals into venture is because I always approach it as a partner saying, look, here's why I'm a believer, I put my own money in, but here's what I think the course looks like, and here's what I think the risks are to navigate, and here's what I think the company is doing about them, creates a much better kind of framework and basis into building the right relationship with VCs and having that relationship be decades long as a way of doing it, because then you can get to a real shorthand, you can trust the person when they tell you, well, we think these are all the risks, so whether or not to take a look closer look at the business or not. So with that, hopefully these are the kinds of things that are useful to this audience, and if not, I hope that the question you come up with will make it more useful. So that's a good question.
Perfect. Thank you, Reed. Give me a moment to change the conference mode to Q&A. I'll be right back.
Would you like your attendees to be able to unmute their own lines by typing? All attendees have been muted. You will now rejoin the meeting.
Okay, we should be set. Reed, we've got a special challenge in front of us. Normally we use one conference line, but with the early indications for this conference call told us clearly that a single system cannot accommodate the crowd. So we've actually stitched together three systems, and they're all jimmied together. So it'll be really interesting to see what happens when people start pressing keys here. But having said that, let's now move, for all the audience, let's now move into the Q&A portion of the presentation. If anyone would like to ask a question, please press *6 to unmute your mic and go ahead and ask your question. Again, just press *6 to ask your question. But please, after you ask your question, if you could kindly, again, hit *6 to mute your mic so that the background noise does not get out of hand. And, Reed, we also had a couple of questions that were submitted in advance, and while people are getting ready to hit *6 to ask their questions, let me go ahead and begin with one of those. What stage in the life cycle of social do you think we are currently in, and any thoughts around that?
Well, I think, you know, one of the trends is like, oh, social is one thing of investment, and then there's new. then it goes on to something else, like mobile or something. I think social is an inevitable part of the fact that everybody is now online with the real identities and the real relationships, both on the computers and in mobile and growing mobile. And I think social is now just a major portion of every piece of kind of what I think of as consumer internet, which includes mobile. Every piece of software, social is a question of, is this product one that should be social or not? And that's part of how you think about this business. And so there will be, you know, there will be new kinds of ideas, whether it's location-based stuff, or, you know, mobile games or anything else. And what you really have to ask is not like, oh, like some of those things will be deeply social. Some of those things will be social a la, they'll connect with Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, whatever. And some of those things will create new social. So the kind of brass tacks answer to the question is quite simply, there's going to be continued new big social things that aren't just the Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, et cetera, as ways of doing this. Some of them will be connected to them. Some of them will be distinct. But it's kind of, this is an artifact of now the fact that hundreds of millions of people are there with a real identity. It's always a portion of how you should be looking at consumer internet investments.
Okay, very good. And if anyone would like to ask a live question, go right ahead.
I have a question for Reed. This is David Plench from Storyful. I'm trying to understand how, as a business, when you have your business going well, how do you get angel investors who don't understand your business to understand exactly how it works? If you're sort of ahead of the curve and doing something very cutting edge, how do you get investors who are interested in seeing something concrete or a product to understand your business if it's very much ahead of the curve, like we're in the news curation business?
Well, it's a difficult challenge. It's not one that I solve that often because, you know, what I kind of do here in Silicon Valley is that I run with a bunch of people who are all very focused on consumer internet, and I basically don't I just don't spend much time interacting with people who don't do that. Now, the small variation can be, you know, all right, they don't get games. They like consumer internet, but they don't get games. And I think this game thing is right. Or they don't get all the consumer internet moving to mobile. And there's a, you know, kind of a useful, interesting, you know, kind of conversation to have with them as a function of that. But the short answer is, I don't think there is a way to, other than kind of time and working with them and kind of helping share the concepts. And generally speaking, it's very hard to get an angel investor, in my experience, an angel investor involved unless they have some expertise in this area, because these companies are so early and so difficult in terms of their, like, the mortality rate is huge, that someone has to either, you know, like, I'll kind of know this well enough to say, oh yeah, I'm really interested in playing. Or they kind of go, look, I like this, but then I don't know how helpful they are in bringing other people on. So, you know, that's kind of a non-answer to your question, but the short answer is I think it's very hard.
Okay, if anyone would like to ask a live question, go right ahead. Reed, there was one submitted in advance. What do you think makes the difference when deals we are looking at look much the same? A good example would be, you know, Facebook versus MySpace, you know, not that dissimilar, yet one eventually dominated. What do you think makes that difference? What should we look for?
Well, you know, the generic is that you know the area to know what is the really competitive differentiation that makes one company win versus not, and you evaluate entirely on that characteristic, even if it's a small difference on the characteristic. So in consumer internet, it's almost always can your growth, you have a mechanism by which your growth will compound into millions. Usually it has to be organic, viral, SEO, et cetera. Occasional models can be paid, usually e-commerce, SaaS, but that this one kills on that vector or even has a small edge on that vector. And that small edge on that vector usually grows to being decisive. If I have completely no ability to really judge them, they all kind of look the same. And this is always actually an important variable, and there's an important variable between them. It's like, okay, well, the plans look the same, but is one of the inhibitors more flexible or adaptive? Because that adaptability is more valuable. Even if you say, look, the inhibitors both look like good inhibitors, but, you know, inhibitor B looks more flexible and adaptive, then that's usually a required characteristic. So, anyway, that's how I look at it.
Okay, very good. If anyone would like to ask a question, just go right ahead.
Reed, this is Bob Grigsby in Atlanta, Georgia. From your perspective in Silicon Valley, are there any strengths that Atlanta is known for?
Well, we tend to be, so much has gone on here, we tend to be a little bit myopic. Because there's so much going on here, you have to pay, like, even just trying to pay attention to everything that's happening here. You know, I'm aware that CheckFree and payment stuff was based out there. I'm aware that there's good tech community and good tech talent. You know, I'm aware that, some, you know, great kind of media companies of various sorts have kind of come out of there. I'm so, like, and this is partially a personal thing, I'm so focused on, because there's so much going on the consumer internet right here, that, you know, the only area where I'd have a slightly deeper answer would be New York, and that's just because outside of Silicon Valley, the only place I see general interesting stuff happening in the internet is in New York right now. I'm in the U.S. I mean, China.
Right. Great. Thank you.
Very good. And if anyone's done with their questions, remember to hit *6 again to mute your mic. We're getting some background feedback. If anyone else would like to ask a live question, go right ahead.
Yes, I just joined right now. I'm late a little bit. My name is John Burney.
I'm from
Canada.
Go ahead and ask your question. Then, Reed, before you answer the question, let me try to mute everybody again, and that should eliminate that background feedback we're getting. So go right ahead with that question.
Yes, can you hear me okay now?
I can hear you.
Okay. We've been working on the system for quite a few years now in the car, for the car business, and there's been lots of change in the car business, wholesale, and probably starting out soon. And we have a few systems developed already that are possibly more advanced than what exists today. It's different. And we were planning a trip to Silicon Valley because I think the timing is perfect. What happened the last few months there in the car business for us to go in. It's a huge market, as you know. Even wholesale is in the billions, $6 billion, maybe $10 billion just in the U.S. So how do we go about approaching and who do we approach? I mean, is there some VC that are better than others or in that area?
Well, Greylock's clearly the best, right, Reed? But before you answer, let me put everyone into mute again so we can take care of that echo. Give me 1 second.
Would you like your attendees? All attendees have been muted. You will now rejoin the meeting.
Okay, I think that should improve the audio quality. Go ahead, Reed.
Yep, and I presume you can hear me. I presume I wasn't that all attendees muted. So I'll answer a more general framework for everybody. Basically Silicon Valley venture folks get tons, like I was mentioning, I get 10 to 30 deals into my inbox per day. So there's kind of three things in approaching Silicon Valley VC. One is, you know, if at all possible, get an introduction, right? Because the raw inbox is so full that you just basically ignore all those. Second piece is, you know, look for where they have an interest in that area already. So folks who have done, you know, invest in Tesla or other kinds of things in the car case, who go, okay, this is the kind of area that we are active in. And then the third is to potentially also look at, you know, kind of the interesting generalists, people who take a broad risk on a new area. If the second area is not sensitive enough. There are some folks who kind of go, look, we like to look at the fringes. You know, DFJ, there's a lot of fringe deals, that sort of thing, where you kind of go, okay, something that's totally different and outside of the skill set that's operant to what we're doing. And that's essentially the kind of highlight. And set up the meetings before you get here, because everyone's calendars are usually packed weeks in advance. Anyway, that's the kind of highlight for a Silicon Valley venture trip.
Okay, very good. And by the way, really, I just realized I did mute everybody without their ability to unmute themselves, so give me 1 second.
Would you like your attendees to be able to unmute their own lines by pressing *6?
All attendees
if yes,
have been muted.
Press 1.
You
if
will now
by pressing *6. All attendees have been muted.
Okay, very good.
You
I think
will now rejoin the meeting.
Okay, I think we're set again, and anyone who would like to ask a question can now hit *6 to unmute your mic. Reed, there was one more that was sent in advance, and let me go ahead and ask that one. And the question is, you know, it's kind of rare for the angels nowadays to see a business plan where there isn't some type of social component, you know, built into it, either as a passing, you know, item to throw in because they thought we might like that question or a predominant part of it. But there can only be so many, you know, enterprise applications that are, you know, social aware. There can only be so many consumer applications that are, you know, socially aware. Does it ever reach a point of saturation where we can just take it no more? Thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I think that how do I put this? You know, in the consumer internet space, basically it does tend to be that there's kind of one function that people use for that sort of function. So if someone's trying to create a generalized marketplace, you're like, well, really, is that going to go from eBay? But if you said, look, actually, there's a bunch of stuff that's around home-crafted goods, you know, you can do Etsy, and then that can work. And so similarly, in terms of the social stuff, it's like, well, if it's like, oh, look, it's going to be another list of your friends, and you're going to kind of have a news feed and do random stuff, you know, kind of in it, or, hey, look, I'm just going to have links in it, or I'm going to have photos in it, and you're like, well, but the links and photos look well-served in other places, then that's just kind of useless. The real question is, you know, when is there social stuff where that social stuff actually has, you know, something new and distinct? And let's kind of go back to Facebook and Twitter. You know, Facebook was like, look, we're a social platform, we're doing everything, and yet Twitter still launched and was successful. And that was partially because, like, look, one global conversation where it's a, you know, kind of an attention of what I'm doing now and the ability to direct attention to kind of a very brief message, making a completely open ecosystem tied to clients and platforms and analytics and everything else, then created a viable thing. And so that did. And so the same thing is true for that when, when you look at a new thing, like many of the social stuff is not, that's already taken, but there is room for new things. And actually this is not an invitation to me to have more things put in my inbox, but I'm constantly looking for new things on the social front too.
Okay, very, very good. Anyone would like to ask a live question? Go right ahead.
Yeah, I have a question for Reed. Reed, this is Mike Grandinetti. I wanted to ask you both from the perspective of someone very focused on the consumer internet, both as an angel investor and now as a professional venture capitalist, what you see as both the pros and the cons of this massive venture capital phenomena. You know, where do you think it's actually helping the ecosystem evolve, and over time with all the new entry of all of these incubators, accelerators, and venture capital programs around the world, where do you see it ultimately shaking out and getting to?
Well, crystal balls are dangerous. You almost always look like an idiot later. Classically, one of the things I see happen a lot in the Valley is they say, look, there's way too much venture capital. There's a limited number of companies that are really billion-dollar deals. This will sort out. But the reason it doesn't really is because it hasn't for decades of people thinking this, is because there's some
companies and entities that are such massive returns that everyone wants to come play a shot at that. And even when, you know, kind of traditional VCLPs, you know, kind of, you know, said, look, I'm going to move from 10 venture funds to 5, other LPs from other kinds of things move in and say, oh, we'd like to play this too. And so, generally speaking, I think that the what happens is areas of venture that have breakout possible returns will continue and over time have tons of capital available to them. And actually, in fact, one of the things that on the side needs to happen a little bit is, and I'm not saying by individual venture firms, because like we also believe in doing software because we think that's one of those great things. And doing that is like, well, how about venture capital in manufacturing or venture capital in, you know, in retail, other things that will be important to the overall ecosystem, and we have to figure that out as a society. But that being said, my view is that consumer internet amount of capital at all levels in, you know, kind of many regions of the world is going to have lots of capital, like basically essentially too much capital available to it, which will then make it more challenging on pricing and returns and a number of funded competitors and all the rest of the stuff. But that's part of what makes the game challenging. Anyway, you know, if I heard the question right, I think that's the answer that I can give. But if not, please feel free to re-ask it.
In the past few years, as Y Combinator and a number of other accelerator programs and venture capital programs have, you know, emerged in the Valley, has that actually allowed professional investors like yourself to get access to a much higher quality of deal flow? Has it made your life easier? Is it allowing for a greater amount of productive innovation, or is it creating too many deals and creating too much too much confusion in the Valley right now?
I think the answer is both. I think there's basically, with more enabling of more entrepreneurs, there are more valuable deals. But on the other hand, there's a ton more things just happening. And it makes it challenging. For example, one of the things that makes it challenging, though, is, okay, like, you know, if you asked me 3 years ago, I would have said, I have a map of all the things that are happening on consumer internet in my head. And I can easily ascertain right now, because there's so many happening at the early stage, that I do not have that map anymore. I have a map of part of it.
Right.
And that's the voice. On the other hand, you know, more great entrepreneurs doing things does create more great deals. So, thank you.
Okay, very good. We probably have a time for a last question. If anyone would like to go right ahead.
This is Nancy Keene from Dallas, and I know the Atlanta gentleman already threw out the question, and I understand the Silicon Valley focus, but Reed, I'd be interested just to hear your kind of top-of-mind awareness thoughts of what strengths might be here in your radar screen in the Dallas area, possibly Texas, Austin to be included as well.
Thank you. Well, so I have zero awareness of Dallas. Which might be me. I do track Austin as good on some technology threads and also some design threads, and know that there is an excellent community there. You know, one of the things that I'd say is that add in when you just compare consumer internet, one of the things that's challenging.
Would you like all attendees to have been muted? You will now rejoin the meeting.
What's challenging about the kind of consumer internet competition. One of the reasons why Silicon Valley works is because people know exactly how fast the pace is and how much is going on competitively, and it causes everyone to run. And so I think that there's a bunch of in Austin. I'd say that, generally speaking, I don't think they all have a level of panic in terms of, oh, God, there's so much happening, I need to run fast. But there's design and tech skills and interactive skills, and, you know, South by Southwest is a great conference. So, I'm not a regional expert outside of Silicon Valley, so, you know, whatever that's worth.
All right. Well, Reed, thank you so much for taking an hour to share your thoughts with so many angels today. Your involvement and dedication to entrepreneurism sets a high benchmark for others to follow. And by the way, we'd also be remiss to not thank you for LinkedIn. What a marvelous business tool. And the groups interaction, you know, I think that probably two-thirds of the angel groups out there use that group's feature to exchange ideas. No telling exactly, you know, how many groups are probably using that. It probably frightened all of us to know how many millions of groups exist, you know, currently on LinkedIn. So thank you very, very much for that. For everyone, some quick remarks on coming events. Everyone on the call today may listen to past events and participate in future events at no charge. You may see a full listing of all future events at angelpoll.org. Again, that's angelpoll.org, and then clicking again on the Knowledge tab. There are a number of HUG profile speakers and panels coming up that will be discussing various aspects of angel investing. The next few events are September 22nd. There will be a diligence panel, What Matters and Best Practices. On October 13th, there will be Chris Dixon, founder and partner of Founder Collective, discussing his thoughts on angel investing. There will be an ACA Southeastern regional meeting on October 19th in Charlotte, North Carolina. It will include sessions on valuations, innovations, syndications, and an update on the new ACA HALO reporting system to help us better track national angel trends and deal terms. There will be an ACA Northeast regional meeting on October 27th in New Haven, Connecticut. This event will feature syndication opportunities and a speaker in the first part of the day, followed by the Connecticut Innovation Pipeline Awards. Angels may attend both events with their registration. And last but not least, the ACA Annual Summit will be held on March 6th through 8th in Austin, just before the famous South by Southwest Interactive conference that Reed had just alluded to. There will also be a pre-summit programming by the Angel Resources Institute. If anyone has not attended an ACA Summit, they are exceptional in both contacts and content. I cannot say enough good things about the last one by MIT this year. If you haven't attended, you owe yourself to attend. This call was recorded and will be available by tomorrow at both angelpoll.org and angelcapitalassociation.org. A special thanks again to our speaker, Reed Hoffman. Fantastic. We really appreciated your thoughts. And again, thank you so much for dedicating an hour to share your thoughts. For all the angels and angel groups that were able to join us across North America, we appreciate your participating. Hopefully this Angel Knowledge series will be useful in your efforts. This call is now concluded. Thanks all, and have a great day. And Reed, thank you again.
You are about to end this meeting. To end, you are the only person still in the meeting.